Welcome back to the latest edition of The Audible, presented by Trader Joe's. I'm Bruce Feldman, joined as always by my colleague Stuart Mandel. And Stu, we have an interesting guest that's going to join us later on in the podcast, who was part of a remarkable team putting together a story that you and I both read. It was an extensive story onto a former football player at Penn State who is a vile predator who terrorize that campus and then beyond. We're going to get into how that story kind of came together, because I think you and I were both really fascinated by the report.
I was blown away by it, and I think it should win a Pulitzer.
Yeah, and I don't know what the Pulitzer competition is going to be like, but it is an amazing bit of journalism. But before we get to Paula Levine, who's going to join us later, I did want to ask you, because there was something that got you really hot and bothered, and it is by Clemson Dabo Swinney.
And it's not the Dabo Swinney thing that has other people hot and bothered. So he did before there. By the way, did you watch their spring game or any of their spring game?
I watched some spring games. I did watch a decent amount of that, because it was like Dabo running commentary throughout that.
Yeah. I was hard to make it all the way through, because it was just like watching a repeat of their team last season, where neither quarterback could do anything. Their offensive line is just completely overmatched by their great defensive line. And if you were tuning that in to be like, oh, what great fixes have they made to their offense? That wasn't
before you go on your rant.
Oh yeah. You know, spring games are meaningless.
No. Before you go on your rant about Dabo, I just want to say, are you intrigued enough by Cade Klubnik, the early enrollee freshman, who, by the way, lit up the Elite 11 last summer, to have him on your Heisman draft watch list that we do internally?
I'm intrigued by him. I think, you know, this is going to just be like totally throwing DJ under the bus, but I think if Clemson's going to contend for national championship next year, it's going to be because Cade Klubnik beat him out at some point in the season, much like Trevor Lawrence. Remember Kelly Bryant started the first four games of that season before Dabo turned to Trevor Lawrence, and that team ended up winning a national championship.
So you are done with DJ Uiagalelei.
You know, they kept Katie George was the sideline reporter, kept raving about how he's in such better shape, but he didn't perform any differently. I also don't know how much of that is we took it for granted for so many years at Clemson. They just always had great receivers, and I don't know that they have that right now. But my thing is more so he did this interview with Chris Lowe at ESPN, and
this is Dabo Swinney we were talking.
This is Dabo. And, you know, Dabo's always been, he says what's on his mind. And I think some people have turned on him sometimes because he's so opinionated. And sometimes those opinions are contrarian. And so a lot of people got fired up because he is still very like anti players making money. Okay. Everybody's entitled to their opinion on that. That's not what I'm focused on. I'm focused on this right here. The question was, has your stance on using the transfer portal changed any? Because he has been over the years very anti-transfer portal. My transfer portal is right there in that locker room, because if I'm constantly going out every year and adding guys from the transfer portal, I'm telling all those guys in that locker room that I don't believe in them, that I don't think they can play. We're also not doing our job as coaches and recruiters if we're bringing in a bunch of transfers. We're not going to build our roster on transfers. To me, this struck me as very stubborn, and Dabo thinking that because he's won national championships a certain way, he doesn't have to change his philosophy in any way. And I think he's asking for trouble, because the sport has changed considerably with transfers being eligible immediately. And so, you know, we talked a few years ago, right? We saw Clemson becoming Alabama's foil and Alabama's equal. But Alabama uses the transfer portal to upgrade their roster. They go get a Jamison Williams, who ends up being one of their best players. You know, you think Jamar Gibbs from Georgia Tech will be one of their best players this year. So are you telling me Dabo is just going to so badly out recruit Nick Saban that he doesn't need to bring in those kind of guys? I don't buy it.
I think you make a good point, because if it's just helping you get a little bit better, maybe one of the kids you expected to be really good maybe they didn't progress the same way. Maybe there were injuries at a position. There's some sort of other attrition. I mean, what Dabo said to a large degree is what I've heard from former Duke staffers. It was how David Cutcliffe felt about it. And it was a strong, you know, like about loyalty and I'm not going to bring guys in and do that. And I see your point. It's going to be interesting to see, will Clemson, you know, like did Clemson reach its ceiling? And now because of all sorts of, you know, their facilities upgraded and they, you know, they, what became more of a national brand. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that is kind of working here. The facilities have upgraded. They became more of a national brand. Dabo as a coach became a much bigger figure. Now they also have lost some really good assistants, right? You know, add in losing Brent Venables, who was a terrific defensive coordinator, losing Tony Elliott after losing Jeff Scott a few years ago. Based on what you're saying, not just of the transfer portal, but giving the context of losing Venables, Tony Elliott, you know, in recent years, and I don't know what you think, but like now all of a sudden, you know, Miami may be much more formidable in the ACC given Mario Cristobal. We know how he's going to recruit there, and they are pushing it NIL wise and being aggressive there. I mean, if I asked you right now, do you think Clemson will not win another national title under Dabo Swinney, you would say?
I would say if he doesn't change his stance on that, they will not. There's no reason Clemson has to go away. They have the cachet, and nobody's saying they need to build there. He said, we're not going to build our roster on transfers. Nobody's saying you should. Most programs still build their roster with high school kids. But what you're missing out on is the sport now has two ways to acquire talent: recruiting and free agency. And everybody else that wants to be a national championship is using it that way. So now if he were coming off a 13-1 season, you'd say, okay, well, they don't really need any transfers. They're coming off a season in which their offense was miserable, in which their offensive line was clearly struggling. You know, some people in that situation would probably take a transfer quarterback, but that's okay, I guess, if he wants to, you know, stick with the guys.
He has arguably the top rated quarterback recruit in the country's there right now.
Yeah. So I'm not saying that's we're not talking about like they've got a finished product roster and they don't need any help. The funny thing about this is that, you know, they've lost guys to the portal, as most teams do. But they have not really used it to, I'm not even talking to like, if you lose a guy and you need to replace somebody at that position, you know, I think even he would say he's up open for that. Do you want to know who is the only, I'm going to give you a quick, say it off the top of your head, who is the only transfer Clemson has taken this offseason?
Hunter Johnson.
Of all people, the guy who left
former
there the first time.
Former five-star quarterback, went to your alma mater.
Struggled mightily and is now going back with no delusion that he's going to be their quarterback. He's going back because he wants to go into coaching and Dabo will give him that opportunity. So they just flat out, he's just stubbornly saying, I'm not going to use this thing. And I think it's a wasted opportunity because they're not Colorado, like struggling to get people to take them seriously. They're Clemson. They have the cachet to go out and get a Jameson Williams type transfer. And he's just not going to do it. And so I think if that's the case, if that remains the case, yeah, they're going to get left behind.
Which ultimately is a bigger problem if you're a Clemson fan, losing Brent Venables or this non-willing transfer stance?
That's a great question. I mean, Brent Venables is a big loss, but we've seen other programs lose coordinators, replace them, and be fine. Now, you could say, is Dabo being too loyal? And
wait. Like, so you said what you said, take Alabama out of it. Like,
well, they're the main example of that.
Yeah. Like, but take Alabama out of it because it's a Saban thing. And I feel like that's a different dynamic altogether. Like, how many other programs have lost like a really top assistant coach and they have not? And I'm not saying it doesn't happen. I'm just trying to think in my head.
Georgia, you know, went to the national title game the first time with Mel Tucker as the DC, right? And then the second time was with Dan.
I don't think like, here's what's different to me about this. And I think highly of Mel Tucker, but Mel Tucker is coaching with Kirby Smart. Kirby Smart is a defensive guy. Dabo's not a defensive guy. And I feel like Brent Venables was a game changer for them. He's a really aggressive play caller. He's just a really aggressive play caller. He has a feel for things. Without him, and I'm not saying that, you know, Dabo's sense on who he promoted up will not work out well. I just think it's like, I'm just trying to think of an example of somebody who was at the top of their game, a program. They lost a big, you know, assistant who was so vital to that. And then, you know, where do they go?
Yeah, you're right. I think usually it's the other way, right? When LSU lost Dave Aranda, that defense imploded. The other thing is, because Dabo is continuing to run the, you know, like, it sometimes feels like he's, how do I say it? You know, like Duke, like they only ever hire former Duke players to be their assistant coaches, and now their new head coach, you know, so he loses Brent Venables and he replaces him with Wes Goodwin, who has never actually had an on-field role at Clemson, though he's been there for 11 years. So maybe that'll work out. I'm not going to rule the guy out, but that's a different approach, right? Than Ohio State needed a defensive coordinator this year. So they went out and got Jim Knowles, the, you know, Broyles Award finalist.
The tricky thing for play callers, especially with defense, but in general, is when you talk to coaches, they said that's the hardest thing to get a feel for is how will he do when he's actually calling in a game if he's never really done it.
Right.
There are guys who are really good on the board. It's a different thing in terms of like what happens when the bullets are flying, you know, and that's the tricky part. And, you know, we'll see how it goes at Clemson.
Clemson is still more talented than most, if not all, of the teams in the ACC. It was crazy. Watching that spring game is crazy that guys like Xavier Thomas are still there. They feel like they've been there forever. And so the transfer portal thing to me is more a difference of, you know, that could be the difference. Ignoring the transfer portal could be the difference between going to the playoff and reaching the national championship or, you know, continuing to have more seasons like last year. If your defensive coordinator hire goes bad, then you could really implode, right? I mean, we've seen that. If you're suddenly your defense is a complete mess, then we might be talking worse than Camping World Bowl. All right, so that was my 10-minute rant for today. We want to get to our guest. It's the excellent Paula Levine, tremendous investigative reporter for ESPN. She co-authored this story this week. It's an intense story. You got to set aside about an hour to read it. Co-authored with Tom Janot about an untold story about a serial predator who was a former Penn State football player. Let's get to her now.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
All right, we're pleased now to be joined by Paula Levine from ESPN. We told you guys about this amazing story, disturbing story that she and Tom Janot wrote on ESPN.com. And Paula, when you read this and you think that the subject of it, Todd Hodney, should be like, how have I not heard this name before? He seems like he should be one of the all-time most notorious predators and criminals, and yet had never heard the name until your story. So I'm going to ask you, how did you find out who he was and what prompted you to do the story?
Well, there's actually a pretty incredible backstory with this that involves my colleague, Tom Janot. Tom actually knew of Todd Hodney back in high school. He played for a rival school, and he recalled when in the 80s, when Todd Hodney was convicted of murder, he recalled that case. And it wasn't until recently, within the last couple of years, Tom was going through some journals that he had kept from, you know, from that time period, that he was going back to as part of some research for a book that he was doing, and came across something that he had written. And it was a note to himself, which was, you know, at someday, you know, look into Todd Hodney. And this was in 2020. And around this time, he had started this not knowing much more about Todd than what he remembered from back then. And he was not aware that there were crimes that Todd Hodney committed in State College when he was still at Penn State. And it wasn't until he started asking around and talking to some of his former teammates that he realized that this is a bigger story. And at the time, Todd had died in April of 2020. And Tom was thinking about doing a story, and this was during COVID. And so there was a thought that he would do sort of a story along those lines. And it became very clear very quickly that this was a much bigger story. And most of the story has been untold. And so this is around the time when he calls me. And I vividly remember when he called me and started talking about this, that I knew right away this was a ripe opportunity to investigate everything there was to know about Todd Hodney. And to answer your question, why on earth, after all the stuff that came out during Sandusky, after all the institutional reflection at Penn State during that time, has no one ever heard of this case? And what turns out to be, as we say in the story, perhaps the most dangerous predator to ever play college football.
For context, for some of our listeners who may not be familiar with who Tom is a legendary magazine writer from GQ and Esquire. And I don't even know if I should use the word arguably, like the great, you know, the best magazine writer, takeout writer, journalist that there is. The fact that you said what you said about the, I don't know if it's coincidence or whatever, that he happened to be, you know, the one who had this connection is kind of, you know, mind blowing in itself. So spinning that forward, you've done some amazing work as an investigative person in your career. And I think about this as you're working, this is obviously a massive undertaking, as anybody who's read it has seen. How often are you sitting there going, as you get into this, oh my God, I can't believe we're going down this Penn State well. Is it deja vu? Because I mean, as I'm reading this, I'm thinking Jerry Sandusky was there the whole time this guy played there. He was like, I know he was like maybe 71 or 70 when he got there. So how, in the context of all that, like, it's not to say, are we having an epiphany about Joe Paterno and the Penn State program and how it was viewed, but as you're reporting this, how are you processing that aspect of like how we looked at it back then? There was just like, it was mind blowing when the Sandusky Paterno stuff happened 10 years ago. Now looking back, it's just even more like, what the hell? You know, I couldn't process that as I was reading it, because I kept on coming back to it because we know of this other stuff and now you have this prequel to it, basically.
Right. You know, that was so interesting when we were crafting the story and talking about how are we making the tie between this and Sandusky. And the answer to that really came from the people that we interviewed, and especially a lot of the women who were on campus at the time of Hodney. When we talked to them about, you know, when, in fact, oftentimes it came up without me asking. Oftentimes they would bring it up, like just sort of out, you know, out of the blue. They would say, you know, when the Sandusky news broke, I thought to myself, this doesn't surprise me at all. This was the environment that was already brewing at Penn State. And it is so true. It's, even though these are different offenses involving different people, though obviously Sandusky had, you know, Sandusky was one of the coaches that Hodney would have worked with. But even though these are different instances with different people, what you can say to what happened at Penn State, as you can say to what happened at Baylor, at Michigan State or Michigan or other schools that have these issues, is that it's never just one bad apple. It's never just one instance. It's a system that over time adopts a certain status quo of how we address these type of incidents that enables bad actions to happen and good people not to do the right thing or not to do as much as they could. And I think that is when you look at these and why we felt it so important to draw that connection. This is another one of those cases where you have, you know, a pattern of behavior with Hodney, with we're not going to talk about this. This guy's gone away. We're never gonna have to deal with it again. You know, this was just an anomaly. And then, you know, you sort of have that level of silence, that level of, you know, we have someone in the story, a former administrator with the university saying, hey, you know, Joe didn't want these things to come out. It was better for the program if they didn't. And that becomes practice. And that is not helpful. It is harmful when you are trying to prevent these things from happening in the future. And you can see how that played out at Baylor. You can see how it played out at Michigan State. You can see how it plays out everywhere else. I mean, it's a pattern, and it's a disturbing one.
It's a complicated situation, and it occurs to me we haven't actually laid out the timeline here yet for people who haven't read the story. He raped multiple women on the Penn State campus. Only one of those cases was actually prosecuted. He was convicted, and in the most probably amazing, disgusting, yeah, like, and like shocking part of your whole story is that he's convicted of rape and the judge lets him go free until the sentencing, and which just leads to this awful, awful crime spree in Long Island. So when you talk about kind of culpability of the university, you know, Joe Paterno's name comes up a lot in this story. I'm going to try to put myself in it's uncomfortable, in the shoes of, if I'm a Penn State fan who still feels a lot of loyalty to Joe Paterno and might say, well, he kicked the guy off the team. He couldn't have stopped him from doing this. Why are you bringing Paterno into the story? Explain why you thought that was an important thread to maintain.
Well, I think it's worth noting he did not kick him off the team because of this incident. In the summer of 78, Todd Hodney got busted for breaking into a record store. And so that's what got him suspended. But he was still, even though he was not playing, he was still, you know, with the team. And Paterno had him room with sort of a straight arrow on the team and had made a comment publicly saying, like, look, you know, I hope that he learns from his mistake and left the door open to, you know, him having like Paterno did with a lot of guys who got into trouble. Like, you know, there is an opportunity for redemption. So it's not as though when this happened, Hodney had been completely separated from all things, you know, Penn State football. From beginning to end with the case in State College, Paterno was involved. I mean, he was the first person that State College PD called when they issued a warrant for Hodney's arrest. He spoke to the players about testifying, you know, who could testify, when they could go. He was definitely, and now at the same time, there was a player who said he was going to go testify on Hodney's behalf. And Paterno said, if you do that, I'm kicking you off the team. And I think what, at the end of the day, the criticism that the survivors and others have about Paterno is that there was a real lack of acknowledgement. And, you know, you can, as a fan, you can argue whether or not he was obligated to do that, but he talks about players bad behavior and using them as an example for, you know, to deter behavior in others. He does not do that with Todd Hodgy. And one of the, a mother of one of the victims, the mother is now 84. This is still something that doesn't sit well with her. She's like, why couldn't he have at least called and acknowledged this and said something? Like, the fact that it seems like even though he was not going to stand up and defend Todd Hodgy, there was also no acknowledgement that this had happened. And it was basically like, how quickly can I get separate from this and never have to talk about it again? And there was an opportunity to learn from this and to use this as, you know, some way to make the system better, or some way to you know, try to reach out to these women, or, you know, he had more power than anybody. And that's where the criticism is, that that wasn't there. And it's not just on Paterno, it's on the university, you know, as a whole.
One of the things that I think came up, and it came up a lot 10 years ago, and it definitely resurfaces in this, is a lot of times when we as the media and we as a society kind of associate somebody having high levels of success with this, like, all-knowing wisdom or something. And I thought was interesting, later in the story you bring up that Joe Paterno's son Jay had talked about in a book later about Joe Paterno's struggles talking about and dealing with, like, matters of sex and how squeamish he was. And you kind of get some of these, like, you just kind of recoil when you see it, and it's out of ignorance, and it's probably out of, you know, you could rationalize it in a bunch of different ways. But I think some of this is rooted in just like an ignorance where it's like, they compartmentalize it, right? Even like, oh, it's not going to be our problem anymore. We've washed our hands of it. And then all of a sudden, the thing that, of all the things that are tragic in there, and there are many, is especially like the judge's decision, all of a sudden, all the other horrific stuff and the lives that get ruined and taken because somebody didn't do enough, you know? And it's just like, and to the one part of this story where it was like, it felt uplifting in this was, and as a reader, I remember Irv Pankey's name just as a young kid. He was an offensive lineman in the NFL. I didn't know he played at Penn State. I just remembered the name. And when you guys start to get into the relationship he has with one of the survivors, you literally get goosebumps because you're like, finally, somebody is stepping up. And I thought, you know, there's, for some of these stories, especially one that you're so emotionally invested in, I was like, you know, there's something that pulls it out of you. Like, when you get to that point, can you kind of fill readers in on how that fit in with where you guys had been on this massive story you live with for so long?
Oh my God. I love Irv Pankey. I could talk about Irv Pankey all day. It was, I remember when I was interviewing Betsy Saylor, who is the main victim, and the one whose case ended up getting prosecuted in state college. And we're like an hour into the conversation. She's telling me all this horrible stuff that happened to her. And she gets to this point where, she's talked about, you know, football players catcalling her and just feeling like she was taking on this huge institution. And she gets to this point in the story where she says that she had come back to campus. She's in this dorm room and she gets this knock on her door. And she says she opens the door and there is this man that is like filling the entire door frame, right? And he sticks out his hand and he says, you know, I can't repeat it verbatim, but basically, I'm Irv Pankey. I was in the courtroom when you described what happened to you. I want you to know I believe every word you say. And then he tells her that she will never have to walk alone on this campus ever again. Like, he's going to be her protector. And he did. He was true to his word. Like, he brought her into his fold. He hung out with her for the remainder of her time at Penn State. And I think it is worth noting that, as most people know, Irv Pankey is Black. And back in the late 70s, he was, I think he says, one of like 12 Black players on the team. There weren't that many Black people, period, on campus. And it's significant because he and Betsy both speak to how this was a key part of his recognition of, I know what it's like to be not just alone, but like a group that, you know, is in the minority. And he says that he did not want her as being someone who is accusing a getting a Penn State football player in trouble. He didn't want her to be a pariah. It was that humanity that he extended to her, that understanding of what I know what it's like to, you know, to be on this campus and, you know, not be part of the majority. And I believe you. I mean, just for any survivor at any point in time, for someone to say, I believe you is crucial, but to come from a teammate of Todd Hodney's who was in the courtroom initially to support his teammate and to come out of that and be like, wow, like I believe this woman. What he did for her was something that few survivors get in that process. And she, in her telling of this, is saying how important this was to her. Like this gave her, she says, a sense of freedom. And when she was telling me this story in the context of all this other horrible stuff that Todd did, as soon as she told me this story, I knew right then, this unto itself is a thing. And, you know, and then of course we interviewed Irv, and their story together beyond that is it's just beautiful. I mean, it is something that we did actually take and make into a film, which is called Betsy and Irv, which will be coming out at some point in the future. But their interaction is, as you said, and as so many people have said, going through it, it does. It just gives you goosebumps. Like Irv Pankey is the example of what all athletes, in fact, just men in general, should do to support women in these situations. And what it did for Betsy, and what you can see what it did for Betsy 40 some years later, is just a testament to how important that extension of humanity is, and just how great of a guy Irv Pankey is.
I would say another, if you want to call it uplifting part of this, you know, otherwise very disturbing story, is that a lot of these survivors had been living for 40 something years with no idea that there were other survivors that had shared this experience until you told them about it. And I have never been in that situation as a reporter to tell somebody something that is basically life-changing. And most notably of all, that, you know, Todd Hodney's own daughter, who had a relationship with him her whole life until he died, had no idea the extent of his history. And you guys were the ones to tell her that. Can you just describe like what that must be like for a reporter when you're sharing something, you know, like this is going to dramatically change this person's life?
I had so many moments like that. And there's always a sort of second when you realize that when you're talking to someone, what she doesn't know, right? And when that often played out was when I talked to the women who Todd Hodney assaulted in Long Island, and they did not know that prior to, they didn't know the whole circumstance. They didn't know that the reason he was in Long Island was because a judge had let him go after having him, you know, be convicted of rape. I mean, to suffer with what's the horrible, violent crime of being assaulted, and then to know 40 some years later that, oh my God, like this shouldn't have, I mean, obviously it shouldn't happen, period, but like this, someone did something so intentional to put me in harm's way. I think for a lot of them, that was a lot of anger. But at the same time, they did appreciate knowing that there were others, especially the women in State College. I mean, a couple of them, Betsy and Karen, were able to meet each other and now, after all this time, develop this level of support for each other. And I also remember, you know, really unfortunately, three of the, well, four actually of the women who were attacked had since died. And one of the daughters, I was talking to her and she was saying to me, she's like, yeah, you know, it's a, you know, I don't know if she said, she didn't say it was a shame, but she's like, yeah, you know, I'd heard, you know, he hanged himself in jail, you know, while after the, you know, after the rape conviction. And I'm like, you think he died after he was convicted of rape? She's like, yeah, my buddy who's, you know, at the time was with the correction system said he hanged himself in jail. And I'm like, no, she had no idea that, it wasn't after the rape conviction. It was after she knew he had been convicted of murder. Sorry. She knew he'd been convicted of murder, but she thought that he had hanged himself. And I said, no, I said, he died this was in 2021. I said, no, he died last year. And I mean, I remember there was just this absolute silence and she had no idea that he had been alive all this time. And it was a huge weight for her because she thought about it in the context of if she had known that he was still alive, she would have reached out to him and she wanted that opportunity to tell him how much harm he had caused to her family and her mother who had since passed. And I just remember, you know, her reaction to that was so, so shocking. And that's something that really, really changed her. And yeah, there were so many of those moments. And as you had mentioned, Todd Hodney's daughter, you know, there are a lot of victims of Todd Hodney. And I would say she's certainly one of them. And I know, you know, Tom Janot has been the one who's been in touch with her and the family. And I know that these revelations have been incredibly difficult for her. I mean, growing up with your dad in prison, that's hard enough. But then to find out after the fact that, you know, you thought he was in prison because of like a, you know, a drug deal gone violent and you find out, wow, it's a lot more than that. That's a lot to live with.
Yeah, it's amazing work, Paula. We can't thank you enough for joining us today on the Audible. We encourage you guys to read the story if you haven't. Paula has done not just amazing work as an investigative reporter for ESPN for a long time, but really important work. I mean, more than that. And as Stu and I had mentioned, certainly on Baylor, but on so many other big stories. And we appreciate you sharing that, and we appreciate the work you're doing.
Well, thank you for highlighting it. I appreciate it.
All right. Last week, Bruce, I put out a call for more and frankly better mailbag questions. And boy, did you guys respond and keep doing it. You always send your emails to theaudiblepod@gmail.com. I love the creativity on this first one from Patrick Hobson, starting right with the very beginning where he says, "Dear Brew and Stoos," and you're going to see why when you hear this question. "I'm here to heed the call. I tried to think of something both creative and worthy of debate. Choose two programs from different geographical regions to merge and create a superpower. So in other words, one school and its fan base will literally relocate to the other and bring all of its resources, including NIL money, tradition, and current roster with it. So the goal is to create a program that will win the most national championships in the next 20 years. And here's where it gets really hard. To make it a more interesting discussion, both current coaches at those programs will be fired immediately, and you must choose any current head coach to be the coach for the entire duration of 20 years. Did you think, put some thought into this one?
I did. First of all, Patrick, thank you for your ingenious way, right down to the way you addressed it. I thought that was clever. I missed it the first time I read through it and then got it. There is one, like something jumped out at me and I was like, I really like this combination. The part I didn't love, and I don't know why you saddled it with, if you didn't say bring your current roster with it, I would say, let's take the Tennessee Vols, who feel like they're the long-suffering Tennessee Vols now because it's been well over a decade since they've been very relevant. And we're pretty sure, they have a strong NIL contingent and
collective.
Yes. And they're aggressive. They have storied history. We know where Tennessee Tennessee's resources are. And let's stick them at Arizona State, where you're in a pretty strong foothold in terms of the Phoenix area, where there's some talent. You're also not that far from Southern California, where there's a ton of talent. And you're not that far from Texas. And also, I'm not sure, like, no knock on Herm, but it's probably sooner than later that they need to part ways with Herm. Anyway, Josh Heupel's done a nice job there, but I don't think either one of us look at Josh Heupel and say he's going to be a guy who probably is going to win national titles there. So, yes, I'm not thrilled at the current roster, although I like Hendon Hooker, and there's some few pieces there, but I just don't feel like they're close right now for competing for a national title. But with their NIL and their resources and in the new landscape, where they'd be on the West Coast in the Pac-12 as opposed to in the SEC, where there's Georgia and there's everybody else in the SEC West. The I don't even know what they're calling them, the TSU, Tennessee State Sun Devils. I would like that mix. And this is, I'm going to combine two things. So our buddy Dennis Dodd did his top 10 coaches under 45 years old. And when I saw that list, I was like, the list wasn't great once you got past the first few. It was a little bit underwhelming. I don't think you're going to get Lincoln Riley. I'm being semi-realistic on this.
Well, wait a minute. He said we could just pick anybody we want.
Oh, if that's the case, then I'm moving Lincoln Riley. Sorry, Lincoln.
Okay. I'm actually very confused. The guy I was going to
take, too. I'm sorry. The guy I was going to take was Billy Napier. Because okay. I think he is one of those guys. And Billy Napier actually has coached it at Arizona State before. So he knows that area. So I was going to take Billy Napier. But if you're telling me in this hypothetical question, I can have Lincoln Riley, I'm definitely taking Lincoln Riley.
So I'm confused. Either I missed something in the question or you've added something to make it even more challenging. Were you under the impression it has to be schools that aren't currently powers?
Yes, I was. Yes. Because why else? Like if you were like choose two programs, I mean, maybe I'm just thinking like, why would I, it's too easy to say, yeah, I'd like to take Alabama and move it to USC.
Okay. Well, I took that approach. I mean, so I'll give you kudos for thinking outside the box. So when I read this the first time, I was like, wow, this is going to be really hard. And then I thought about it some more and I was like, wait a minute, why wouldn't I just combine Ohio State and Alabama?
Where are you putting them?
And make Kirby Smart the coach.
Where are you putting them? Are you putting them like, I mean, that was the case. You know what? I would take.
It says one school and its fan base will relocate to the other. So Ohio State would relocate to Tuscaloosa.
How about I do this?
I mean, talk about us. This would be a hell of a superpower.
Combine Alabama and Georgia and make Ryan Day the head coach.
You can't. The current coaches are getting fired. That's why I didn't. That's why I didn't do
Alabama, where Nick Saban, as great as he is, I don't expect him to be.
You're combining Alabama and Georgia.
Combining Alabama and Georgia to make Ryan Day the head coach.
He said choose two programs from different geographical regions.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
So that's why I picked, like, I could have done Ohio State and Georgia to get Nick Saban as my coach, but I don't know that Nick Saban is going to be my coach for the next 20 years. Yeah. So I'm combining Ohio State and Alabama, who both have amazing current rosters. And even though we're going to lose two really good coaches in doing that, Kirby Smart is 46. So I'm feeling pretty good about that.
Okay. Good question, Patrick. Well put together. Next question is from Chris in Seattle. Hi, Bruce and Stu, and hopefully Max. Well, hopefully Max is listening. Max,
good compliment to Max, though.
I know he's a big hit, and we don't force feed him on low grade seafood products. So love your podcast. My question to you both is, what is holding schools north of the Mason-Dixon line back from joining the ranks of the elite? It seems that the only two schools typically mentioned in the elite from the north are Oregon and Ohio State. However, schools like Texas A&M, Tennessee, Ole Miss, Miami, etc. are starting to garner the attention of top-level recruits And yet they don't seem to produce at the levels of comparative schools up north, like Penn State, Iowa, Wisconsin, Michigan State, Washington, et cetera. Why is that? What is preventing these schools? And I think he means these schools being the latter from getting these elite recruits.
Yeah. I mean, that's a good question. And the answer, the low hanging answer for years.
I think we should take Penn State out of that because Penn State does get a bunch of elite recruits.
But his point is they're not winning necessarily at that level. So
it's not a question of are they get, but he's saying what is preventing these schools from getting these elite recruits?
Okay. Yeah. Well, Penn State is getting the elite recruits.
You know, the other schools, the other four.
I get it. The other four are like kind of.
They just don't seem to recruit the same. They more develop guys and find under the radar development guys more.
Well, the simple answer is that none of those places are in good recruiting areas, right? And it just the proportion of talent that is in the South, and I'm talking Texas through Florida, just gives all those programs that he mentioned an inherent advantage. Now, that being said, recruiting is more national than it's ever been. Ohio State, it used to be under Jim Tressel that Ohio State would build its whole roster practically off Ohio kids, but Urban Meyer changed that. And I think Ryan Day has as well. And, you know, they go and get kids from Texas, Florida, and California, and the DMV, and so on and so forth. So the question would be, well, then why can't these other programs do that too? I think recruiting is very, it's hard to break the dynamic. Like there's just certain programs that have always been good at recruiting and will always be good at recruiting. And it's hard to break into that club. Now, Oregon, I think, is one that has over the last 15 to 20 years. You know, Ole Miss never used to be mentioned among top classes in the country. So it happens. But I think that the fact that Iowa has been as good as they have been for so long. And if I had to get, I don't have it in front of me, but I would guess their recruiting classes are not ranked all that differently than they were 15 to 20 years ago. It's just a tough cycle to crack, don't you think?
You know what's interesting is, so you mentioned Ole Miss a second ago. Do you remember when Freeze did crack that ceiling?
And immediately.
All whistles and bells went off back then, right? It was Robert Kimdichie. It was the big receiver from Chicago. Laramie Tunsil was in the mix. You know, it was a lot of dudes, and they those guys turn out to be good players too. But it was like, what's going on there?
Why there's so much innuendo about A&M's class last year. Anytime somebody rises up and does something recruiting that they haven't done before, everybody just immediately suspects it's fishy.
And I think they do when you're on the top of it. Like, I think people forget that. You know, there were some big recruits that Ole Miss lost to Mississippi State in that mix, right? You know, it was like, but it's like when you are the one who's the shiniest at that point, I think that's at that point gets a lot of attention.
Now, the dynamic that could change this, theoretically, is NIL. That's certainly what's driving Tennessee's surge in recruiting right now. So if those same rich, remember, wasn't it one or two super rich Michigan State boosters who are paying Mel Tucker's $95 million salary. Like if you could get those guys to pony up $8 million for a quarterback, then suddenly Michigan State might start shooting up the recruiting rankings.
Yeah.
Why
don't you ask me the next question?
Eric Schneider from the Netherlands. Considering all of the coaching and camps that five-star high school quarterbacks get nowadays, do you think they can actually improve that much in college as compared to the past? Joe Burrow being the exception, it seems that many highly ranked QBs you see as a freshman are not much better as a junior or senior. That's an interesting observation.
It is. I do think guys can get better. I think one of the things that's a very lively debate among coaches is how much more accurate a quarterback can get. Now, Josh Allen is the best example of somebody who got way more accurate once he got to the NFL. There's a really good example of a good college quarterback who's going to the NFL now, and Desmond Ridder. You know, I talked to some coaches who are like, I don't think he's accurate enough to be a really good NFL quarterback. And yet when you talk to some other coaches who've played him over his career, they're like, well, he did get more accurate on the deep ball. They noticed that. And so I think you can get better, but it's going to be interesting because so much of it, I think, comes back to how they're used and how they fit the system. Joe Burrow, I think, flourished. He continued to improve, but they really shaped things around what he liked to do well. He obviously had a ton of talent to throw to, but the guy who ended up, you know, he improved a lot from year one at LSU over the course of year one. By the end of the year, he had made dramatic improvement, and then it kicked up a notch with the off season. I mean, I think there are certain guys. Kenny Pickett got a lot better at hit over his career.
Jalen Hurts. Jalen Hurts went from
great as a freshman, though, in that.
But he was the guy who nobody trusted to throw downfield. Remember, he was known as a running quarterback. And then his last year at Oklahoma, he's, you know, Heisman runner up, one of the best passers in the country.
I also think there's a lot of stuff that players are sorting out. Like, one of the more interesting subplots of the season is going to be how much better, if at all, is Spencer Rattler at South Carolina. He had a ton of hype last year. He's in the first wave of NIL, and he really was you know, basking in it. And they struggled. He struggled. And now he's gone on to South Carolina. And we'll see how he does in his second act there. But I think you see, you know, so that's another case where I'm not saying, like, his, aside from the change in scenery and change in coaching staff and talent, I don't know if there's a lot of parallels between he and Joe Burrow, because Joe Burrow wasn't hyped up, you know, early in his career at Ohio State, or really much as a recruit. But I think there are quarterbacks you're going to see, like, okay, how much better is DTR? He's played a lot. How much better does he get? You know, he's in the same system. He's been there for a while at UCLA. Is he the guy who flourishes? I think you look at some other guys we've seen, and a lot of them, you're like, okay, we kind of know what this guy is. And, you know, whether it's like a Sam Howell, who had a really fast start to his career, and then maybe the talent level wasn't as good around him. It's not to say he got worse, but I think it just, a lot of it depends on the circumstance and the players around you.
Yeah, I do think that the guys were like a Kenny Pickett are the exception. It does seem to me that, like, I think who the kind of guy he's talking about is Bo Nix, who has a inconsistent freshman year, but he shows promise, and you assume he's just going to get better from there, and he kind of is the same quarterback.
Well, look,
Brock Purdy was like that.
Penn State has a quarterback who's played a lot of football. Now he's gotten injured, but, you know, he's definitely got some ability, but you're wondering, like, how much better? Like, here's an example, like Max Duggan at TCU. There was a lot I really liked about him as a freshman, had some struggles in, you know, in 2020 coming off injury, or illness. I'm trying to remember what the medical, you know, diagnosis was there. And then it took him a while to get back. And then, you know, I still think there's tools there where he can be a top level college quarterback. We'll see if it, we'll see if he lights it up under Sonny Dykes in a new system, you know. And but I kind of agree with the question of where Eric is going, because a lot of these guys are probably more ready to hit the ground running because of the reasons Eric said in his question than they were 15 years ago. But, you know, how much more better do they get? It's usually marginal. All right, next question is from your old stomping ground in Atlanta, Georgia, Brian Black. Hi, Stu and Bruce. Pitt finally had a breakthrough season last year, winning the ACC. Pitt just extended head coach Pat Narduzzi, replaced Kenny Pickett with USC transfer Keaton Slovis, and competes in the easier Coastal Division. Penn State has had back-to-back underwhelming seasons, just signed the number 6 recruiting class, and gave head coach James Franklin a 10-year coaching contract extension. Which will happen first? Pitt will make the CFP under Narduzzi, or Penn State hiring a new coach to replace Franklin? Okay, Stu, I want to add something onto this. Early in the season last year, you were done with Pat Narduzzi. You had written him off and said, hit the bricks. Now, what do you think?
I mean, it was a phenomenal season. And I think now what we need to find out is how much of it was Pat Narduzzi and how much of it was, you know, this like, is Keaton Slovis necessarily going to do what Kenny Pickett did last year. You know, Mark Whipple, the OC that helped produce that great season, is gone. You know, to me, whether Pitt has staying power remains very up in the air. That being said, James Franklin just signed this huge, huge contract, this 10-year contract, and at least as of now, seems like he'll be their coach for a long time. So I think this is a very tough choice. But I'm going to say, and also, given what I said about Clemson earlier, there might be that there's a window right now for Pitt to make the college football playoff. That being said, I think I'm going to say the James Franklin scenario would happen before that. I just looked it up. His buyout is $12 million right now, but it falls to $8 million. You know, it's a substantial commitment by Penn State, but it's not that substantial a way to get out of if he were to fall on his face. And of course, what if he, you know, decides to bolt after all? These 10-year contracts seem so, you know, like, okay, we don't have to talk about this anymore. And then, you know, 1, 2, 3 years into it, you're like, well, actually, it wouldn't cost that much to buy him out.
Hey, do we have time for one more?
We do.
All right, Stu, I'm going to ask you this. You've become our NIL aficionado from David in Los Gatos, California. Last episode, Stu mentioned how NIL collectives are going to be a big deal for recruiting. And even though USC as a school has a lot of money, it doesn't help in NIL or recruiting. Is there any restrictions on universities directly hiring and signing student athletes to NIL type promotion for the school? Schools using athletes' name, image, and likeness to promote ticket sales and merchandise seems like a very natural fit. Alternatively, how can laws that enable NIL and being paid for work not inevitably result in directly paying players?
Complicated question. For the most part, I think most schools, first of all, there's a lot of state laws that flat out say a school can't get involved in brokering and arranging NIL deals. Even in ones where there aren't, the schools tend to be playing that conservatively. But I believe in California, there's some gray area about whether the schools can do that directly. I don't honestly know.
My understanding was from talking to people at some of these universities and positions of authority, they interpret it as they could initiate. That's how they talked about it.
But when you say initiate, I believe you mean initiate a deal for, you know, to endorse a some third party company. What he's suggesting is the schools just flat out cut a check to their players to do, you know, an ad for ticket sales. That I think is a no-no because that would basically be pay for play. And that's, there are very few restrictions, but that's one of them.
And I think there's a pretty easy workaround on that. If you're going to say, hey, we have these big boosters who are going to spend, you know, again, I use the example of if you wanted Reggie Bush when he was at USC, since that was brought up, since Daniel David had mentioned USC, if you have Reggie Bush and you have big boosters, Reggie Bush comes to your kid's birthday party and you pay him $100,000 or
right. You know, but the key is the boosters are paying them, not the school.
Yes. But it's, I mean, let's not kid ourselves. It's like kind of just funneling the money through a different way.
Right. Well, you know, USC as of now does not have one of these NIL collectives, and it remains to be seen whether that's going to put them at a disadvantage in recruiting against schools that do have those.
I mean, based off of the news last week, Josh Connelly, a top West Coast offensive lineman who's in this class, so he would be eligible to go to training camp this fall. He chose Oregon over USC and among other schools.
Oregon has a very, you know, their collective is basically Phil Knight. I mean, he doesn't like run the day-to-day of it, but he's definitely behind it. And they would definitely be in a position to make a big offer to a kid they really want. Great questions this week, guys. Great questions. Keep them coming. As always, you can send them to theaudiblepod@gmail.com. We'll see you next time.